Well, okay, thank you. This last part of our program is somewhat unstructured, and as the medieval said in Latin, quod libido, meaning whatever you want, really. But, I mean, that what that meant in practice was that people asked all kinds of questions. There have been a number of themes today, and so we wanted to provide a format, perhaps, to revisit those. And that entails conversation between everyone here, so meaning, in other words, people at the table talking to each other, but also talking with you all and questions and comments and conversations. And so we've asked Professor Wilkin if he would kindly chair the session and kick us off and perhaps also moderate us, especially, you know, when Father White or any other unnamed persons get out of hand. He will make sure we stay the course. And we'll moderate, and we'll take questions from the crowd. Is that your understanding? Is that
fine?
Okay, great. So, without further ado, I hand it over to you.
Well, I guess maybe the way to begin, in light of what you just said, for those who are not Catholic yet, the question is there anybody who is welcome to this discussion who's not a Thomist? What I mean by that. When I studied theology and got a good scholastic formation, I was Lutheran, not Catholic. I remember the word normans, and then norma normata. So I guess the main question that kept coming to my mind is Thomas the norma normans? By which one then looks at everything else, or is it a norma normata, which is subject to. And then that, of course, relates to the larger theological world. This was a very rich, deep discussion, but it is a discussion that's very much turned in on itself. If one had not kind of paid the dues to enter into the discussion, it's very hard to know exactly what one is to say. The other thing that struck me is that coming at Thomas from patristics, I mean, I've had Thomas on my shelf probably for 35 or 40 years, but for me, Thomas is someone that I consult when I want to be informed on a certain issue that I know he's going to clarify. And I love the way Mr. Fowle put it, namely that there's just something about the precision, the removal of all effective languages, that it allow you to kind of come to clarity so that you can go into other things. But as those of you who do spend your time with Thomas, we realize that there's a lot of other dimensions to Thomas, and the one, of course, having come at it from patristics, is Thomas in light of the Bible. Commentaries are now being read more seriously and put into the theological discussion. And the question then comes up is, you know, whether Thomas is the place where one begins for all questions, or whether he's someone sort of comes in at certain points, and then at other points you want to turn elsewhere. So, as you can tell from my comments at the beginning this morning, I am kind of an outlier in this crowd, in the sense of not really being in that particular tradition, and I think also the question that I wanted to pose, which came up a number of times during the day, is we're sitting here in a room in a library in a secular university. At most, we had here probably 40 people today. And we've spent a lot of time talking about finding a place for Catholic theology within the university. But the university has been so much in the background, and we realize all the things that are going on in this university, And I guess maybe to put it a little more pointedly, is Thomas the best way to deal with the question of Catholicism and the university, or Catholic theology in the university? I'm sure there are strong opinions on that.
Well, give us the other options.
Yeah, what's the alternative?
Yeah. I mean, I don't say politically.
Well, I spent my academic life in a religion department of a secular university, and I thought that interpreting Catholicism through the Church Fathers, not just Augustine, and the Church Fathers as the way into the Bible was a very effective means of communicating something about the nature of Catholic theology. Now, I realize you don't get the kind of clarity, you don't get the kind of precision, but what it does allow is a little bit of history. In the 1940s, Jean Danielou and Henri de Lubac began publishing the series Source Chrétienne, which is a series of translations of patristic texts. And they had been formed, of course, by the scholastic tradition, which really has its root in Thomas. And they were self-consciously trying to do something different, and so they deliberately didn't go at the dogmatic texts in the Church Fathers, but went at the spiritual writings, biblical commentaries, liturgical texts, and so forth. And there's no question that with the translation, enormous accomplishment of the last two generations, that these kinds of texts, patristic texts, have had an enormous impact on students in the American university. And I'm not arguing that that's the way to go. I am just saying that there are other ways in which Catholic theology is being received and heard and studied other than, so that's my point, is whether, you know, Thomas is a Norman or Mons, or the Norman or Mons, whether and I don't want to be provocative. I mean, I'm not trying to.
Well, but to ask that question is to answer it. It's a Norm. It's Normata, because, I mean, obviously, a good Thomist understands that Aquinas is always himself only a resource in reference.
Well, no, I understand that. I mean, that's why I say I'm not trying to be deliberately provocative. I'm just trying to say that, having sat here now for the whole day and heard, you know, discussion of all the technical, in many cases, and metaphysical questions, epistemological questions to a certain extent, those are some of the thoughts that I'm not sure I'm going to be introducing this, but since Thomas Joseph asked me to introduce it, I figured I might as well take the chance.
Well, I mean, someone correct me if I'm wrong, but like, I kind of think St. Thomas would agree with me, but like, isn't it really about knowing your audience? I mean, isn't it really about knowing that person that, like, when you're having an interaction, you're still having an interaction with an individual or group of individuals, and you have to kind of really know something about them to know what is appealing to him, like, or to them. Like, example, if I go down the road to Campbell University and start, you know, talking to people there about St. Thomas, is that going to be as well received as St. Patristics because of the just keying off the way that you can key into Scripture right away in a lot of the patristic writings, but maybe not necessarily, although it might be a little unfair to St. Thomas to say not necessarily right away in St. Thomas, but if you're in a in a biology laboratory, you know, being able to talk to somebody about St. Thomas seems like much more readily available. And you can even talk about Aristotle, and then talk about Aristotle, you know, the, you know, Aristotle was a biologist. You can say that directly to the person, and they can say, oh, okay, like, let's get back to dissecting this cat or whatever. And I mean, so I just kind of, you know, think maybe in the in that question, is it about knowing our, knowing who we're talking to? And I kind of think that it is Thomistic to say like, I recognize you, person I'm talking to, as your own individual rational being, your own individual instance of a rational being that is uniquely you, and you have your own experiences that form you as that person. I'm going to address that person, not to the point of knowledge, because I've known you, you've made an impression upon me, not the straw man that I painted you as the radical college liberal or the mechanical engineer that doesn't have an empathetic bone in your body or something.
Okay, thank you. Are you going to do it?
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah.
In response to that, I'm going to respond to the initial question. So I'm not a Thomist. Maybe one of you in the room. I somehow made it through a Notre Dame theological education by only taking, like, patristic classes and classes on theological imagination, and somehow missed that piece of my theological education. But have been told since that I'm a Thomist and I don't know it yet. I've been told that by many people. But for me, so as a clinical psychology graduate student, I teach undergraduates, and I also see patients here at Duke. And the value of this for me is in the structure of discourse, particularly as it was discussed in the third talk. And it's a lot of what I actually see in therapy and working with patients, in working with patients on very evidence-based practice that has been derived exclusively through the scientific method and through repetition of randomized control trials. And the real value of those treatments and those cognitive behavioral treatments is in teaching people how to recognize their perception of reality and be able to hold various perceptions of reality that they may experience in discourse with one another, and hold those things lightly, construct that discourse, taking very seriously both sides of those arguments in order to arrive at a closer approximation to the truth. So it was really beautiful for me to hear that, because what I've experienced with a lot of patients, and particularly adolescent patients I work with, is often if they are not convinced by what is a more useful thought or a more accurate thought, is often because they have not yet constructed a very convincing argument for the opposing thought yet. And in order to really arrive at this approximation of truth, they need to construct very convincing arguments for both sides and weigh them with equal merit.
Good. Okay, John.
Maybe I'll throw something in, though it's not really that learned. But I'm going to pick up on something that Robert said, and because I think I admire Thomas, so but my mind is somehow attuned to a different key, and so I think, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom. So Thomas, absolutely, and I wouldn't do without him. But I think I guess my mind is contoured more according to the literature I read, I suppose, which is mainly patristic, and I find that students do respond, and partly I think it's because when you're reading the fathers and teaching the fathers, you're also you're receiving a sort of scripture infused discourse. The fathers, you know, have a kind of scripture infused discourse, and they have faith, really. Origen, for example, despite his bad rap, won't ultimately translate the scriptural language into a system or into a philosophy. He will always use, even when he talks about souls, he'll always use the, even in On First Principles, the narrative of the descent into Egypt and the liberation of it to talk about the most spiritual things. He won't translate. There's a kind of interesting biblical positivism there. And the faith is that these words of Scripture are are spirit-filled words.
Sorry.
And part of the project of theology, so I'm going back to your point, I'm still thinking about it. Part of the project of theology is learning to speak those spirit-filled words and learning to allow them to carry the, I don't know, the brunt of persuasion, so that in some ways you're learning to speak them in a way that you get out of the way. I'm not saying you really erase yourself so much as a speaker, but somehow the voice of the beloved and the voice of the bridegroom, somehow you have to let that appeal out. And I think that it ends up so that students, in a sense, learn a way of speaking. Or they by practicing with the fathers, you learn a way of speaking, you learn a kind of language, you learn a way of appropriating mystery, which is not fully, finally speakable, but Scripture gives us a language to somehow grow into it and stretches you. So there's a certain kind of appeal, I think, to patristic literature in a kind of almost hortatory mode that nevertheless... The exhortation that it releases is the one that Scripture in its spirit-filled words offers us.
Yes, ma'am.
I'd like to concur with this young man over here and speak a little more concretely. I've spent 35 years working in a secular university in a library. And over those 35 years, I'm a lay Dominican, so Thomas is a big deal for me. Over those 35 years, there was a time when I would have just naturally gone to patristic literature to try to have a conversation with one of the students that works with me and to bring them to an understanding of Catholicism. And when you work in a library, you have these kind of conversations. Because the vast majority of the students, even 15 years ago, the vast majority of the students that worked for me, I'm from Charlotte, UNC Charlotte, would have been Christian, would have been raised in a Christian environment. I cannot tell you the last time I had a student that identified as Christian. I would go to Thomas much more readily now, because you have to start with the most basic understanding of God, and Thomas is better than that.
And sorry to keep talking, but that's one of those things. I mean, coming from a not, like I said, I made the joke about not being in the academic world. I'm out of the business world, whatever. One of the reasons I love talking is because it's like, I'm like a kid in a candy shop right now. Like, it is great to be able to talk about all the stuff I never get to talk about, but like with anybody, hardly. But part of it is like, there's no vocabulary on which I can walk into. I mean, I've got very, very good friends that I've been friends with for, decades now or whatever. I would never be able to even start with a conversation about, patristic literature per se or a lot of other things, because there's no shared vocabulary because of the difference of lives. But I think that with St. Thomas, though, that, I mean, they're definitely, you can work on that vocabulary much more readily, and you can start making.
I tend to agree with both of these two points. I think, granted, I'm committed to the value of Thomism itself on its own terms. But prescinding from that, I think we have to think about kinds of people, and we have to think about the times in which we live, for sure. So I am a person that tends to think people are either natively Platonic or natively Aristotelian. I just think that's the way people are. My husband is a Platonist, and he will remain that way. My example I would give, because I mean, this obviously that's not a learned statement, but my example that I would give is my students. When I teach Thomas, invariably my best students are the engineers, second only to anyone else in the natural sciences. My worst students, every time, are the English majors. It's just a very interesting thing that people who tend to be scientific-minded, it's purely anecdotal, in my teaching, tend to be more oriented towards Thomas and otherwise. So I do think people are more, open to an aesthetical approach or more open to a more rational approach or whatever. I think that's sort of ingrained. But the other thing is also with our times. Now, part of the way my paper was set up the way it was is to say that Thomism seems to be a particularly good response to the troubles that happen to Alice right now. because we live in a time in the West that is overrun by like sentimentalism, I think that that more rational approach is very, very helpful. But also because we are living in increasingly secularized post-Christian times, I also, for the same reason as both of these people are saying, think that Thomas is the most accessible. Even if you have, like, I mean, it's like, consider, like Justin Martyr, like Dialogue of Tito versus the Summa Contra Gentiles. What is going to be your point of departure today with someone wholly outside of the tradition and wholly outside of the common text? You know, I think the Contra Gentiles is really the sort of the right approach.
Okay.
I mean, just as a quick response to that, and then I have to follow on what Dr. Cappadini has to say. But the idea that, and just to play devil's advocate, that St. Thomas, working in the environment where he was, in Christendom, is the best response to paganism in the culture, strikes me as an odd proposition. I mean, I think there are situations in which that does play out and clearly works with some, but the folks that are here at the Thomistic Institute events, for the most part, are going to be people that are particularly responsive to that kind of discourse. I do think that the fathers, I engage most heavily with Tertullian, Cyprian, and Augustine, are writing in times that are more, that strike me at least as mirroring our own much, much more closely. And so I don't know if Dr. Cappadini, I'm sure, can speak a little bit more on this, but they have specific answers to the kinds of questions that people are asking in a more pluralistic society, I think. Their writings are occasional. Is there great value, in some sense, to the when those occasions, we find ourselves in those same occasions again? So that's all. I'm just playing devil's advocate here.
So I'm not playing devil's But I want to preface what I'm saying, but I don't really want to get into an oppositional situation. Like, I am absolutely, in some ways, addicted to Thomas. It's a secondary addiction.
I am secondarily addicted to patristics.
Thank you. So, let a thousand flowers bloom, and yep. I think we have different temperaments, and I think what we're able to put in front of students, partly effectively, varies. But I want to reiterate a little what you were saying, because like the Contra Kelsum of Origen, you couldn't find a cultured despiser of Christianity now. Well, you could, yes, but I mean, Kelsus is a very virulent cultural despiser, cultured despiser of Christianity, and the tonality of Kelsus is so familiar, I think, to what you find now. And the sophistication of the response is exactly, it seems to me, talking about what Scripture really is. What does it mean to talk about Christ risen from the dead? What is it? These things that seem to have no resonance with contemporaries, they had no resonance with Kelsus, none. And so how do you, to watch Origen take steps to dismantle it, is astonishing, and to make it available to students. And the same thing with Augustine, who writes, the other magisterial work of apologetics in Christian antiquity and forever, as far as I'm concerned, which is the City of God. And the cultural hermeneutic that he develops there, based on the notion of superbia, as the attempt to replace God with ourselves, meaning to claim that we are the source of meaning and replace God as such, and the ways and all the cultural pathologies that come out of that, this is very alive and now. And many of the deconstructionist philosophies and tactics today, the radical deployments of the hermeneutic of suspicion, I mean, Augustine is the primal prophet of suspicion. The notion of pride calls into question all cultural artifacts, and yet it's not finally a deconstructive tool because it's located in a larger revelation. So to find someone who's able to deconstruct the deconstructors or outdo them and yet not, and yet be part of a constructive project seems to me to be incredibly valuable in our time. And I think it's important to remember that theology has different charisms. Thomas has one. I don't want it replaced. I don't want it erased. I want it amplified. But it doesn't do everything. And the fathers also have a charism, a modality that we also need to recover. And I think that's helpful. That's all. I mean, I don't want to be in opposition. But I also want to hold up my end of it.
Thomas Joseph.
Yeah, I just have, I mean, I think we're talking about here maybe a healthy convergent perspectivalism. I mean, I was trained in the fathers before I studied Aquinas, and I definitely had my life changed by reading things like Athanasius' On the Incarnation as an undergraduate, because somebody gave me that book to read. I teach a lot of people at first-level graduate school who've come out of elite schools and feel like they didn't get a sufficient intellectual orientation on some fundamental issues. And I notice that though they admire and are greatly helped by Aquinas' theology, which ultimately I'm more a champion of, it is actually more the philosophy that helps them often feel like they've gotten a fundamental orientation. So I think there is a kind of philosophical disorientation. It's very acute in our own era, and Aquinas is very helpful there, and I don't think we should take anything away from him there. I think actually his star is rising in conversation with the modern sciences and analytic philosophy. That being said, there's a lot of other kinds of things that have to happen in a theological education and even just in a general human culture, which Aquinas can't substitute for. One of them is historical learning. I mean, you don't acquire historical consciousness by just sitting down and reading Aquinas. Understanding sort of the history of ideas. If you really get into the deep sort of wellsprings of patristic but also modern theology and read Aquinas adjacent to other historical sources in the Middle Ages, that's a larger theological culture, and it's actually essential for right formation. Another one that John just referred to is a sense of moral diagnosis of the torments of the human heart. And although you can get some of that, like in the deep analytical structures of Aquinas' analysis of human action theory, really clearly, actually, you get much more into that through Augustine or Dostoevsky or the two of them together or something like that, and in conversation with Nietzsche. But another last thing I want to mention is like the spiritual life. I mean, Robert mentioned that initially with like the first work that they translated to Lubach and Denier Lu was Life of Moses by Gregory of Nyssa, which is a deep symbolic depiction of the inner life of ascending to the mountain of God and the dark apophatic encounter with the essence of God in the life of grace. And that is something young people have not been formed in when they do these Kara studies of people. If you ever had a religious experience in church, Catholics come in last. And mainline Protestants are not doing well, and evangelicals do a little bit better. But the thing is that, like, that people can discover there is an interior life, and that there's a spiritual writing tradition about the interior life. You can't just get that from reading Aquinas. That's got to be taught by reading, things like the Itinerarium of Bonaventure or Julian of Norwich or Francis of Assisi and Teresa of Avila. So these things go together. They're part of a larger project.
And there are a couple over here. Okay, yes, sir.
Yeah, thank you. My question, I think, goes to this question of reading our audience, of what seeds of the gospel there might be in our culture and what needs to be evangelized. And actually, I'd like to take us back to something from the first presentation, from John's about truth for the sake of truth and utilitarianism. So we have a lot of utilitarian students. So one of my most profound teaching experiences, I taught in a state prison for 2 years prior to seminary, and about half my students knew they would never be enrolled. I'm not sure if they wanted truth for the sake of truth, but they wanted the discipline of study for the discipline of study's sake. And about half hoped to be paroled soon, and wanted an education so they could get a job which would help them not go back to doing whatever they were doing that got them into incarceration. And I don't think that was a bad motivation. I think that was a really good motivation. So I hear truth for the sake of truth being a hold of utilitarianism, that there is a really virtuous utilitarianism that can drive someone to study. And so here, I mean, at Duke, you talk about the exploration of STEM. Really, it's the exaltation of engineering and medicine. I mean, the pure sciences are being left by the wayside as much as the humanities. Because of this utilitarianism. So I just want some help thinking through what is really good about this. Like my incarcerated students that wanted to get an education that would help them contribute to society. And what is really kind of worrying and hopelessly utilitarian, and how do we respond to that as Catholic theologians?
Thank you.
Well, my question, maybe it can be similar in that I'm wondering, so one of the problems addressed was utilitarianism, and so I'd love to hear talk about good kinds. But mine is also a flip side. How do we integrate the kind of criticisms of postmodernity, self-interest, this libido dominandi that people like Vadimo or Derrida or others say are part of knowledge? How do we find this internal intrusion that integrated into this very inspiring vision of unity that people are talking about? Is there a way to bring that in as well without leaving totally behind the criticism of knowledge?
You're asking me?
I think he's just making a statement.
Oh, okay.
Yes, sir.
My question is actually a very similar one. So I think this morning we had a lot of great conceptions of what a university should be, whether it be a Catholic university or Thomas's conception of a modern university in any sense. But it seems to me that those are sort of utopian visions of what a university is. The institutionalization of the research university, which sort of founded on a certain utilitarian method that is the sort of utility of non-utility. Schleiermacher conceiving of the Humboldt University in Berlin, one of the first research universities, argued that the state should fund the university because the university provides a utility to the state, which is Bildung, creation of what he calls wissenschaftliche Menschen, the scholarly humans. But the pursuit of that wissenschaft, that scholarly pursuit, is without utility. And he conceives of that in a pluralistic orientation towards truths, of which theology is sort of one of the many. So my question is, given that we're not conceivably the 40 people here today going to change the university itself and create this utopian university, does the role of theology become simply a sort of apologetic role towards those who have fallen off the track? Or is there another conception of which theology has a place within this pluralism that is not just reactionary to the world, but sort of not just a conservative?
Well, I guess I should ask one of our panel then to address that. Who is...
which of the three questions?
Well...
All good ones.
Let me take a stab at it. I think that the model that in 1809, 1810, Wilhelm von Humboldt and Schleiermacher devised was remarkable, first of all, because the timing couldn't have been worse. I mean, Prussia had just lost a major war, it was an occupied country, and the first thing these guys could think of is, let's make a new university, I mean, let's see what happens. That was wild, and yet it was a stroke of genius. I think the premise behind it is fundamentally in continuity with the sort of formation of the person that you see also fully sort of embodied in the sort of sequencing of questions in the Summa. There is a sense that knowledge is something to be cultivated because it is only, and here their dependency on Goethe is palpable, is only through the praxis of inquiry that we actually come to understand who we are and who we were meant to be. That a knowledge that in a way wishes to short-circuit its way towards outcomes, one of these horrible words that are now, of course, ubiquitous in the modern academy, that in a way wishes to prepossess those outcomes and think of the actual activity in the university merely as a means towards securing those outcomes is in a way a false or at least a badly misdirected knowledge. And I think in that sense, there is a fundamental continuity between, say, the Platonic Academy and the Platonic dialogue as a sort of formal embodiment of that ethos, and what you see all the way through the early 19th century. But it is also, I think, fair to say that this model of a university, though tribute to it is still being paid, sometimes eloquently, is largely dead and gone. What we now have is certainly not a university in the sense of something turned towards order, but something more of an agglomeration of more or less mercenary pursuits that tends to be identified with the university simply because these pursuits happen to unfold in the same place and the same type of building. So I would say two things in response to the bigger question. The first is, there is a major shift that happens at the beginning of the 20th century when the idea of mass education, of mass higher education, takes hold. Prior to that, and certainly all the way, certainly prior to World War I, you would have had maybe, you know, between 1 and 5% of the population, say in Germany, harboring any expectation of obtaining a university degree. That meant that you had already an extraordinary amount of self-selection happening before these individuals showed up. And they were all very much products of a certain kind of educational system at the primary and secondary school that made a focused and often very much in-depth study a natural thing to pursue. The first casualty of mass education, and is inevitable, and I'm not saying it's a good or bad thing, but it is simply a casualty, was the idea that those who are in the university speak a common language, that they are essentially coming to this place with a shared body of knowledge and a shared body of competencies. I'll mention in England, I mean, if you look at Oxford, it's very interesting to see what the entrance requirement for Balliol College were in the year that Hopkins showed up, 1864. You would be hard-pressed to find a graduate with a BA in classics today meeting those requirements that were then required for entering. So the degree of social stratification and consequent cohesion that was once presumed is no longer here. So in that sense, I think the role of the university has shifted simply as a result of the sheer quantity, and with it, the profile of the students and what the students will need. They need a much broader, a much more diverse set of competencies offered to them at the university. Add to that what I think is exactly right, and this was what the lady on the right, on the left here said earlier today. Add to that that we are now sort of in a robustly neo-pagan world. In some ways, rather more so than say, Origen or Tertullian. Because at least at that point, there was some agreement that there was indeed, however one might go about describing it, there was a coherent cosmos. That was something on which people of various religious backgrounds fundamentally seemed to agree on. That idea has also disappeared. So I see, in a way, to come back briefly to the question of what role, if any, can one reasonably expect, say, Thomism or other forms of canonical Christian thought to have or to fill in lending a greater coherence and also a greater effect to higher education. I think it's a question of who you are speaking to, as the initial question had pointed out. If we have students who are seeking actively, then I think the kinds of apologetic writings that patristics offers in such abundance and diversity is a good way to go. If you have students who come to you, engineers for instance, who have great analytic gifts, but who are perhaps not particularly addled by habits of introspection, then what I think what you will want to do is you want to meet them with a vocabulary that in some ways matches or maps onto their own. And here Aquinas strikes me as certainly the first choice I would have. So I think we need to be very flexible, and it's not a question of, we shouldn't allow sort of competing traditions within the church, or to the extent that it's even reasonable to describe them as competing, to sort of, you know, lock us into one or another scenario. I think one would have to be very pragmatic here. Just to close, I taught 10 years ago, roughly, I taught a course, an introduction to the English major, always a great class to hijack. I taught it on spiritual autobiography, and there were only two texts on the syllabus, Augustine's Confessions and Wordsworth's The Prelude. And by the time we were done, and we essentially read one book each session, and that happened to work out exactly. And by the end, to the last student, the 15 in that seminar, said they were persuaded and felt on solid ground with Augustine. And they never quite did with Wordsworth. And I don't think my presentation was that biased. It was somewhat biased. But it was, I think, and what that told me, and I think it sort of gave me a lot of ideas for subsequent teaching, it told me that they are, aside from the particular propositional architecture of what these texts tell you, they are looking for an authentic language, one in which they don't feel that they are in some sense being manipulated. And it is, I think, when you read someone like Augustine or Julian of Norwich, I think you feel that. And I think you are much less likely to be so sure of that when you read someone like Wordsworth, or let alone Rousseau. So that, I think, told me that their quest is not simply about thematics and concepts and propositions, but it is a quest for a vocabulary that might allow them to achieve a higher level of self-description than they have previously done. And that's what would be, I think, to me, in consideration of an audience, that would be, especially at the undergraduate level, the principal criterion for choosing texts from here on out.
Very nice speech, very nice. Thank you very much. You want to follow up since it's your question?
Thank you very much for that response. So is then the role of theology primarily oriented towards students, and or is there some sort of role of the theologian towards our very well-intentioned but often on a truth basis misguided colleagues who sort of promulgate opposing ideologies which are incompatible with Catholicism?
Well, speaking for myself, I place all my trust in the students.
It's what? I didn't hear you.
I place all my trust in the students.
Robert, can I say something on this? Or no?
Yeah, sure.
I think there's analogies between universities right now and the giant oligarchical corporations. I mean, they're only gaining cultural importance and prominence, but there's a widespread distrust about, I mean, we depend upon them. You know, we order things on Amazon expected to come in 2 days. But we really don't expect them to give us personal fulfillment in our own atomized individual lives. So there's a strange sense of inevitability of these massive, powerful organizations and corporations, and also a sense of potential estrangement that we don't necessarily feel the warmth that they have our good at stake in a personal way. So it's not to say that these dinosaurs, if I can shift to a metaphor, are going to die soon, but it might be a good time to be a little mammal, like a squirrel, because it might be on the evolutionary story that you're going to be around longer. And so this is where I think Christian wisdom is actually, is that we've got these powerful institutions that are absolutely firm, they're very firm about locking out, for the most part, public Christian intellectuals. It's not easy if you're an outspoken public Christian intellectual to get a job anywhere or tenure anywhere. It's not impossible, it's unlikely. And so, but inside the institutions, as like the example that Robert gives for you, 30% of students at the University of Virginia are Catholic. So, you know, and a lot of them are evangelical Protestant and whatnot. So you have deep existential interest. And so what we need are new, I mean, I say this is obviously what we're trying to do myself, but you need new delivery systems. But when you deliver, then you find that you have students open in ways that actually they will intuitively bond with the formation they're being given, often through para-institutional formats, which people at the heart of the institutions can participate in, as we all know, because the more that the university sees a professor as primarily a commerce unit and a publisher, and a, you know, the less that they really care what he's doing or she's doing in their personal time mentoring students. So I don't think the institution is being evacuated of its existence, but I do think that there is something like an open format, despite the really aggressive political correctness, which is a sign of a crisis, in my view, and a defensiveness and a brittleness that show a lack of strong identity or strong confidence, knowledge of what's going on, what a university should be. Despite that real ideological presence, I think there's also a kind of utilitarianism that's evacuating the university of meaning, which makes space, actually, for we might call them remnant initiatives. And you may say, well, I want to be more than a remnant. Well, I could say, I mean, the Orthodox Jews have accepted to be a remnant, and they're a pretty creative remnant. But I would also say, if you're worried about Christian thought being a remnant, who isn't a remnant? I mean, are the Nietzscheans really running the show? Are the Rawlsians thriving? How's it going for the Kantians over there? It's all very frail. And when it's that frail, you know, you can complain about your fragility or your weakness, but you're not actually on. There's been an ecumenical drumming down of the importance of all these different positions, and so you're actually, it's kind of a level playing field. I think that's healthy.
Now, this gentleman here had a question. No, you wanted to step in here?
I don't really want to preempt anybody's else's comments.
Well, that's what you're doing, though.
Sorry.
I didn't have a question.
Okay, with that, this is an observation that I hope will open on to a series of questions. The observation is this, that across the day, we've been asking, it seems to me, three different questions, variously, at different points. One of them is something like given title of Professor Cavanini's talk, which is there a place for Catholic theology in the university? The second is, ought the university be Catholic? Something like that. And the third is, how can we make students or lead students to become Catholic or become better Catholics in the university? That's a rough taxonomy. But I would like help sort of disaggregating some of those questions, because it seems to me that they're different, they're distinct. They each probably have their place. Does that make sense?
All right, so now you can speak.
Well, I'm still hung up on a previous question.
Good.
The cluster of questions that started with the good utilitarianism and then good postmodernism and then also utopian. Like utopianism. So I want to disambiguate myself from the charge of utopianism. I'm not a utopian thinker, and I didn't mean to put a utopian ideal out there. Since I was chair of a theology department for 13 years, like, I really know, like, this is the corpus permixtum, okay, so that you're working with in this world. So I'm trying to put out a non-utopian version. Okay, what I gave is a theory, so it sounds utopian, I guess, but I think it's utopian it's anti-utopian in its, I think, ability to be self-critical over time and yet not deconstruct itself, yet reconstruct itself. So think of the Rule of St. Benedict. I'm going to give this as an example. The Rule of St. Benedict certainly puts an ideal out there of a certain kind of community which puts the love of Christ before everything else and has this beautiful vision of monks in mutual obedience, etc. But it has a very, like a hermeneutic of suspicion sewn into it. So the abbot's not supposed to prefer someone who's a slave over someone who's a nobleman who comes into the monastery. So social status is no private property. So you're not so ownership is not a source of disrupting. And the point is, anytime the community starts looking more like the world than like the rule says it should look, you have the grounds for reform. You have the rule, and those grounds for reform are ultimately based in the gospel. Because what comes into the world, Jesus Christ, does come in the first instance as a dispossession. And not a dispossession, though, that has no substance. It's love divine, all loves excelling, which appears in this way and appeals. So that there's both a positive construct always, or the potential for it always there, but also a self-critical space, which is something like postmodernism in the sense that it tends to be deconstructive, and yet at the bottom, it's constructive. And I think all apologetics, you asked about apologetics, all apologetics has that the two phases of a kind of a tearing down. Origen brings this up in book 5 of the Contra Celsum, and a building up from Jeremiah, and a planting. They go together, anyhow. So that's not exactly utopian, but it isn't either giving up.
I had a question more geared towards style of rhetoric. Like, what should our tone be in engagement with culture? Like, someone who I like a lot, though I see sort of like problems with his approach sometimes, is like David Whitney Hart. He, like, especially in something like Beautiful the Innocent, you know, it's just sort of an intense rhetoric. But it's a strong rhetoric, but it's also sort of an amusement of like the absurdities that at times he feels like he's dealing with. So it's like it's good natured in a sense. And I guess one thing that's helpful for me is it's easy to talk about sort of just being, you know, open and, you know, just sort of offering to the culture. But when you have a culture that is sort of in a position where that it's not going to care, like, oh, it's great that you're offering me something, I don't want it. Like, when is it okay to? Because I think there's times where you have to push back, and not in a way that's necessarily mean-spirited, but in a way that's sort of critical. I mean, you can do this through satire, too, I think, with something like Waugh and his novels, and sort of like, you know, it's despairing of like what's going on, but it's a joke at the same time that allows you to do that in a similar way, maybe. So I just, maybe some thoughts on like what sort of rhetoric should we engage in, what's responsible.
Anybody want to speak to that? Anybody in the audience want to speak to that?
Well, I might, in a way, sort of push back against the question, not with hostility, obviously, but just say that I think every one of us will, in a way, only be authentically able to have one voice. And it's our business, generally, in life, to try and find it, and the university happens to be, with all its imperfections, nevertheless, happens to be one of the better places where we might just be able to do that. So I certainly enjoy reading David Bentley Hart within limits, and I admire the sort of gusto. He reminds me a little of William Hazlitt in the early 19th century. But I know perfectly well that I could never write like that. That's simply not who I am. And so I think that the sort of, you know, panoply of voices that we should try and create is itself something very much to be welcomed. That does not, however, mean that the voices are simply sort of disconnected. I think they all ought to hit sort of, ought to issue from certain fundamental and I think non-negotiable convictions. But in the end, I mean, the poet Heinrich Heine once nicely said that, you know, once you publish something, it's like, you know, shooting an arrow. Once it's left the bow, you have no idea what will happen to it. You know, it'll hopefully hit the target, but so writings will, of any variety, of any stylistic and rhetorical variety, and of any kind of, you know, technical or general audience type of theological level, will hopefully have some positive effect. But I'm resisting, and this room in which I always had, as department chair, always had the meetings with the deans, makes me resist even more. I resist very much the idea of sort of, you know, trying to get everyone to agree to a particular line, and from here on, this is what we will be doing. The corporate university generates that all the time, and it's I think it's not helpful. I think find one's voice is a great thing, and it's a rare thing actually. And I mean, maybe I should add this: when Paul Griffith, who unfortunately is not here now, when he said earlier today that he actually prefers the university in which, frankly, you're just left alone to do what you do. Well, of course, the university never really quite leaves you alone. That much, and it can't. It has certain expectations of everyone. But I think that whatever we do, and in whatever idiom we write, whether as Thomists or in Augustinians or what have you, we write always deep down with the hope and the longing for a certain kind of community that may eventuate as a result of our efforts. And so I can't follow Paul Griffiths all the way to that particular sort of, you know, independent contractor vision of the university. I don't think it's realistic. It doesn't actually quite comport with the essential things that we do as teachers. We try and reach people. We try and help them find themselves and inform thoughts responsibly, effectively. And we are finally all committed in our own ways to a form of mental discipline. And now that's the epithet I used earlier for Aquinas, who I think in a particular way I think exemplifies that perhaps more than any other theologian in history. So that's why I think it's good to, I mean, there is a certain pluralism, but the pluralism is not one of substance, but rather of styles. And then I think that's how it should be.
Can I say something?
Yeah, I want to, you can go.
Oh.
No, go ahead, go.
Well, only that I too have sometimes heard David Bentley Hart speak and wondered if he was causing some people to be, turn some people away from the very message he's trying to deliver. But you can't help but think, you know, maybe Daniel Dennett does need to be insulted, things like this. feedback. But I just wanted to read this. I looked at something on my phone, and I...
It's the little one. Just turn it off. Just turn it on.
If you just hit the button right there.
The right button. The self-destruct button.
Okay.
Sorry.
Anyways, I just wanted to read this little passage from Augustine in instructing beginners in the faith. Here he's talking about those who would want to come into the church, but I think what he says is applicable to anyone when trying to bear witness in the mission field that is higher education. So he says, although we owe the same love to all, we should not treat all with the same remedy. And so for its own part, this very love is in pain, giving birth to some, makes itself weak with others, devotes itself to edifying some, greatly fears giving offense to others, bends down to some, raises itself up before others. To some this love is gentle, to others stern, to no one hostile, to everyone, a mother. Well, it's rather poetic, and you might say, well, what does that really mean at times? But I suppose the notion is charity solves a lot of this, and it sort of knows how how to behave as concerns its audience.
I wanted to speak to that. What my experience and my strategy has been, I received a theological education, very solid, orthodox, and then I went to the University of Chicago and took a PhD in church history, and then I came out and I began to write, and I assumed I was writing for an academic, intellectual kind of audience, of a general sort, not for Christians, certainly, but some Christians. As the years went by, I realized that I was changing, and I was self-consciously writing for Christians. I knew that the things that I wrote would be of interest to others, but it changed my whole perspective. And the second thing that happened when I wrote The Spirit of What a Christian Thought, I realized, not at the beginning, but maybe a third of the way in the book, that my tone was beginning to change, and I wanted to write from faith to faith, from heart to heart, not from head to head alone, because obviously it was going to be faith. And I have been astounded at how many people come up to me out of the blue and say, that book made a difference in my Christian faith or my coming to Christian faith. And so for me, I think that one of the problems, especially people who come out of the university who are in theology or related disciplines, they do not think that they are writing for Christians. They think they're writing for some nameless person out there, and they're always sort of conditioning everything that they say. Now, it depends on the field that you're in, of course, so in terms of the rhetoric, the term you used, I made several self-conscious decisions along the way. And let's call it a day. It's been a long day.
Thank you so much for everyone for coming and for your attention.